Terrific. So welcome to everybody, and thank you, Rex, for joining me tonight and agreeing to spend some time with everybody on a variety of topics that's useful and relevant and interesting to all of us. I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
As am I. Thank you very much.
Before we get into our content tonight, I'd like to make sure that everybody has pressed *6 to mute themselves. I think you may have to turn it once or twice on or off just to make sure that you've toggled it off. The mute should be on so that in case you cough or the phone rings in the background, another phone line, etc., that it won't interrupt our recording and such. So please make sure you're muted, each and every person on the call except for Rex and me at the moment anyway. And you do that by hitting *6.
I love the notion of mute yourself. I love that. That's such a cool phrase. Mute yourself. *6 yourself. This has got to, because, you know, everybody's growing up texting. This has got to be something that translates into classrooms, you know, of preschoolers and then eventually, you know, grade schoolers, things like that. Go, mute yourself now. *6. *6. We'll replace it can replace
star
rip
six.
The lip, you know,
mute.
Shut up,
excellent.
You know, be quiet. It's just *6.
So we have tantalized those folks who have arrived for this evening's call by talking about as much of the following three topics as we can get into tonight's call within reason without sacrificing the quality of the conversation. So we know we're going to talk about your background, and we know we're going to talk about the deep value of an immersive practitioner training as opposed to some of the shorter courses that are out there. And if we have time, I'd love to spend some time talking about the deep value that people get from high-quality feedback loops. Why is that so important? And why is it so much better to get extraordinarily well-structured exercise drills as opposed to self-study? Not just paying lip service to the idea that a live course is better, but I'll share my experience as a practitioner student at your course, and hopefully that'll springboard into some further topics. So we may get to that tonight. So I'm very, very excited. It's just a great opportunity for me to chat with you, and hopefully we'll bring lots and lots of great value to everybody here as well.
Cool.
So where do we begin? I'd like to begin by introducing everybody to you. And before we do that, before we explore your background, as a quick reminder to people who are on the call tonight or perhaps who are listening to this in the future, if you find extraordinary value in tonight's call and hopefully future calls, please do take some time to share the subscription link for the list that you signed up for with friends. I want to make sure that the download links and such and the details for these calls are not being spread directly to other folks, but that the subscription link at my website is the one that people share. This is an amazing opportunity for people to get access to an experience, or part of an experience at least, initially anyway, that I had training with Rex for my very first practitioner course attending. And I had such a profound life experience, and he's remained to this day one of the strongest influences on my education with NLP and my exploration in life. And without question, this has been the result of a 15-year journey and dream. I had that profound an experience attending Rex's course and having the experiences that were offered to me as a student, and I really think the field has been impoverished since 2001 when Rex decided to pursue other dreams. That's the message I'm hoping to get across by this interview, and hopefully you'll get a taste of that as well. So where to begin? We begin by asking you about your background, Rex. I'm fascinated to know more about what brought you to NLP. Can we start there?
Sure. But first let me say I'm humbled by your comments, and I appreciate your comments, and as a testament to you, you know, a presenter, a teacher, a mentor, guide is I think in many ways no better than the student is who should surpass them anyway. So your desire, your passion, your dedication to excelling is what makes the difference. And that's not something that people do from the outside. And with that, I would say that I came to NLP as many, if not most people come to NLP with, you know, feeling that something was lacking or feeling in places that was not effective or not powerful and wanting to be more powerful. I was a child entertainer. I grew up entertaining a group movie business and doing live events and got into hypnosis as a young kid and the mind reading and, you know, and entertaining and all this kind of stuff. It was in the movie business, and, you know, mind design and NLP kind of paralleled itself. I had mind design is something that I developed. It was through a personal crisis in my life that I came to discover certain insights, and I had been involved in hypnosis since I was about 11, and discovered NLP around 79 when Frogs of the Princess came out, and then sought out people who could, you know, provide training. But it came out of a hole in me, you know, of wanting to be better, of wanting to be more complete, of wanting to be able to be more powerful, and wanting to be able to get laid, and wanting to be able to be a success, and wanting—I mean, all the kind of reasons that most people probably come to something like NLP. NLP represented
very common. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say what NLP represented really in the early days, because there's a couple of things I'm really good at. One is always getting to top people in whatever field that I'm interested in. I've always done it in my life. As an early person, I was a true believer, born-again Christian. I got to the top evangelists. I got to the top faith healers. I wanted to be a faith healer. I wanted to scream and shout and dance and rain down hellfire from heaven and the whole thing. And modeled very successfully these people and ended up building it. I didn't build it myself, but creating a church, co-creating a church in Los Angeles with people, and it grew into the thousands. In Hollywood, I've always gotten to the top people in Hollywood, and NLP, it was getting in, you know, with the top people in NLP or in therapy or, in, you know, whatever endeavor I've been able to, and in the movie business. My radio show right now, I talk to people who are, you know, professionals and top of their field. So I've always had that ability to find a great source and get to it. And I've always had the ability to compartmentalize my life. I mean, while it seems like I haven't been involved in NLP for 12 years, I certainly have been. It's behind the scenes. It's in other ways. And it's different from actually presenting the live trainings. But when I was in NLP, I tried to keep a lot of my other life, like movie making or my personal presentation shows, separate for a variety of reasons. So I'm good at keeping secrets, I guess. And NLP, I mean, I digress, but NLP was marketed in a way of, because I had also done therapy and in Los Angeles while I was doing acting and teaching acting. I was, you know, continuing to study hypnosis and study therapy and offer therapy and counseling and worked as a psychic counselor and worked as a therapeutic counselor and worked as a hypnotic counselor and all these different things. So NLP came along and said, hey, we got a faster way to make changes in people. And not only that, it offered, you know, the ability to persuade and influence and to get your own way. And that probably, more than anything, is the thing that attracted me. You know, if you could have instant rapport with somebody and connect with them, wow, then the whole world would open up to you.
Most people who would know your name from your work in NLP probably know you through your company, Idea Seminars, that was active from about 1990 to about 2001, 2002. Is that correct?
Correct.
But that's not your full history. I mean, you mentioned 1979.
I got involved, and I went around to different practitioners and studied and worked with practitioners and master practitioners and different trainers. Ultimately, I ended up getting training and get certified from different certifying bodies, including Bandler. But, I mean, I worked with a variety of people, and I worked with a variety of NLP disciplines and hypnosis and meditative practice. I was a seminar junkie and went to anything and everything I could afford, and anything I couldn't afford, I found a way to afford or to get in free, to volunteer my time or some way. And in fact, in the 80s, it actually harmed my career as an actor because I was gone almost more than I was available in Los Angeles. So I lost out on lots of jobs, and my agents would go, well, where were you? And I was out of some retreat or some seminar or some program. But I used to teach a program called Discover Your Excellent Self, which was a Yes workshop. And at that time, I was partnered with a gentleman in Chicago, and that was in the 80s. And prior to that, I was doing seminars on my own in California. You know,
but not only were you teaching, but you were also attending courses from lots of different places. I just want to bring everyone's attention to this, that at the core of Rex's original history, he was already exemplifying or behaving in accordance with the principle known as requisite variety. Rex was getting a vast array of different educational experiences, and it became part of who you are as a trainer, I think, anyway.
Well, I appreciate that. Let me point out this, and that is, you know, a growing plant or a living human, we're never done until we're dead. I mean, you know, we're continually growing, and unless we stop breathing, you know, we continually, we're alive. And what most people, you know, food is done. You know, you can overcook an egg. You know, at some point it's finished, but your own learning, your own life, your own experience is never complete. And the other thing about us that, in speaking in terms of the value of a mentor or coach, is that unless you're an expert already, you can't judge yourself. And that is the benefit of having a guru or a mentor or a guide or coach, someone who can look at you in an unbiased way as much as is possible, or as an objective way, who can find your strengths and your weaknesses and help you enhance your strengths and help you overcome your weaknesses and help you create balance in your life by bringing your attention to things that you wouldn't be aware of. I mean, this is, to me, the most important thing, because what happens is people will say, like my son might say, well, I can't do that. And you know, we know the presupposition, well, you can't do it yet. But what happens is when somebody says, I can't do it, they're making a judgment about something of which they really have no experience and no expertise in making that judgment on. They can say, well, according to my past history, I'm no good at this. But you can't be no good at something if you've never done it before. You can't even begin to evaluate it. And people do that all the time. They try something once and go, well, I'll never learn it. Or they try something once and go, I suck. But,
okay, I've got to jump in and say thank you for bringing that up, and I would love to table that for later in the call when we get to more focused attention on feedback loops and the critical value of some mentor who's observing our patterns and gives us information from outside our own system and awareness.
The
critical point.
We'll table that, but I say that because you acknowledged something about me and that I was doing workshops while I was also teaching. The point being is that I'm not finished yet. I still seek outside help. I still go to other mentors and other guides and people who know more to me in other areas of my life or in things that I want to grow and develop in, because we ain't done until we're dead, you know? So this is part of my journey. Even now, I mean, it. You know, that's why I say it looks like I may be finished with NLP because I stopped giving public seminars in 2001, but I'm not finished with NLP, and I'm not finished with my own personal evolution, nor am I done with assisting other people in theirs. It just appears to be that way because I like to be the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz and Veil and Cloud Men's Minds like the shadow, but other than that,
I see your work with Rex as an example of not only being the interviewer to help other people, but also you're doing modeling when you're doing those interviews. You're learning more from the people you get to interview.
Oh, you mean with my radio show right now? Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when I first started my radio show, I tried to take the premise as though I know nothing. And well, that was fallacious. That lasted 4 or 5 shows, and I said, I can't do this because it's, you know, the questions I'm asking obviously belie somebody who has some knowledge, so why don't just come clean and go, okay, I have some experience in theory, and we'll talk from that. But my goal with my show is to let the listener experience the person I'm interviewing and try to ask questions that will assist the listener and benefit the listener and add value to the listener that they would otherwise not get because of my experience with modeling or my experience in eliciting information from people. So it's kind of a vicarious modeling process for other people, but the success of the show from a listener's standpoint, I mean, I'm very pleased with the outcome of that and the fact that I get such great guests.
Amazing guests. So we'll come back to your NLP background, and you had mentioned that you had gravitated, after having had extensive training with other folks, you were starting to gravitate more towards Richard Bandler's work.
Well, I always, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, could you tell us more about when you started training with him, how that evolved into you supporting him and also starting to develop your own stuff, both by modeling him and also playing and exploring. And as I recall, we talked about how you were working with some other extraordinary minds at the time and people like John McWhorter and Eric Robey and more.
Well, I was lucky to come into Bandler training probably in the mid-80s or close, about around the mid-80s, somewhere in there, and to study with Richard. I'd wanted to do it. I'd been enamored with Bandler and Grinder, been exposed to them earlier on, found their different approaches. I gravitated to Bandler in I guess, in a sense of being less intellectual and more charismatic and more hypnotic, more entertaining, and John being more professorial and more, you know, small chunk kind of thing. I mean, they're kind of different strokes for different folks. I fell out on the Bandler side, no disrespect to either of them. So I definitely wanted to work with Richard, and I did. I did classes and somehow got close to Bandler. Again, like I said, I always get close to people that I want to, and started, you know, doing my training and my master training and master prac and trainer's training with Richard. I had already been certified by another company in training. I was a trainer, I think, at the time, and again had been doing seminars, you know, for probably a decade in change technology before I met Bandler, and doing NLP seminars for probably almost a decade before I met Bandler. I mean, it was a carnival ride. I spent a lot of time hypnotically modeling Richard. I don't recommend that to anybody. I don't recommend hypnotic modeling really to do that to anyone. I mean, you do need to set safeguards, so you need to be careful when you choose models about what you want to model. You don't want to model the person. You want to model the ability, which is
Absolutely. Something
else. And so you want to be wise about what you do. So, you know, I got close with Richard. We worked together. DHE came along. DHE was the brainchild. The name was the brainchild of Richard. A number of collaborators worked on it. Richard, obviously, I think Chris Hall, Eric Roby, Will McDonald, Gary Yardley out of Australia, myself. I know John McWhirter was there at some part. Laval was there in the early days, and DHE came about. That represented kind of an extension or a different way of thinking about NLP. And then,
so by DHE, for those who don't know, we're talking about Richard Bandler's Design Human Engineering. It's his trademark title for a lot of work he was doing at the time, which had a lot of contributions from some extraordinary minds, and Rex's was one of the core minds in that process.
Yeah, we spent a lot of time, you know, working it, refining it, coming back. Then I was the first person that Richard and I decided, I mean, I was the person Richard and I decided would also offer DHE. So I offered DHE, and Richard offered DHE. And then at some point, I just decided I didn't like, there came a time in my development, because I had been working in other areas and working with other disciplines, and because I have been a meditator most of my life, there came a time when I went, you know, I don't like the mechanistic outcome of this. It's great to build machines, and it's great to hallucinate these things, but same thing with NLP. You know, I mentioned that NLP, you know, allows you to have power. One of the, I'm gonna digress, and in doing so, I hope people will follow and understand. When I offered practitioner trainings at one point, I went, I want to have everybody better than anybody else. I want to have the top notch practitioner, master practitioner. You know, we will do everything we can to make these people the best practitioners ever, so that, you know, when people look at them, they are the lighthouse version of it, what a practitioner should be. And that was a goal that I had for myself in terms of training. And there came a time when I realized something about NLP, that people come to NLP. I said I came for power. I came because of a hole. But what I ultimately realized was that I came to NLP, as I did many things, in that I wanted a better existence. I wanted a nicer life. I wanted more rewarding relationships. I wanted to have an incredible experience. I decided at one point, I said, you know, the world is my garden, and if it's going to be my garden, I want it to be what I want it to be, and I want to enjoy every aspect of it. And I want it to be a paradise, and I want to invite people into my paradise, you know, and make it a terrific playground. And NLP and DHE didn't represent that to me for very long. It represented aspects of that, and it represented small pieces of that. You know, how do you get somebody to overcome a phobia? How do you get to connect with this person? How do you overcome resistance in a sales situation? But the question that I always had is, why do you want any of those things?
Oh, and wait a minute. That's a key question, Rex. Why? Ooh, it's poo-pooed in some circles.
Well, this was just it, and this was the thing that I introduced back into NLP that people seemed to miss for a long time, and that was that, you know, when you read the meta model and everything, so we take out why. We don't want to know why. We don't want to have anything to do with why, and why is an incredible motivator. It's the thing that tells people exactly why you want. Why are you doing that? Well, I'm doing it because of this. And if you elicit enough, you find out, you know, you can chunk up enough to the fact that people want a better experience. They want a more fulfilling life. You know, the reason why they want a better car is because they want to feel fulfilled in some way, not just because, you know, a car is a car. They don't want just piles of cash. They want to have the freedom to do anything, anytime, at any place. You know, so it's always a bigger, it's always a higher level interest or concern. And I looked at NLP and I looked at the way it had been trained and I looked at DHE and I went, you know what, we're majoring in minor things here. We're dealing with little tiny nuts and bolts when we should be dealing with the bigger issues. It's like a puzzle, you know, you build a puzzle piece by piece by piece until you get a big picture. You know, you're building from specific to general, or you turn around, you look at the picture, and then try and find out what parts make it, and you go from general to specific. I like the general piece. I like the big picture piece. I like to go, you know, if you're heading out on a trip, you know the destination you want to get to. Now it's just a matter of getting there, and how do you get there in the most pleasing, wonderful, enjoyable, ecstatic way possible? And that's what is when I kind of left DHE and kind of introduced mind design into the NLP programs. And I didn't say, okay, this is mind design and this is NLP. I said, I'm going to run the NLP program through my mind design program, and people will learn NLP in a different way than they've been traditionally taught, both in the regular education system and traditionally taught in NLP programs, where they broke everything down into the tiniest components and then kind of spoon-fed it back to them, hoping they'd understand it. I said, we're going to start the other end. We're going to go, let's have the most incredible experience and then do all the things that you need to get that experience without ever telling them that this is a technique or that this is an approach, just saying, do this. And then at the end of the program, people come along and go, wow, you know, my experience, or a year later, they go, wow, I'm doing so much better. And it was a way of tricking people into having a better experience without making a technique or a procedure out of it.
So that's wonderful. Let me recap something of what you said so that we can make sure we're on the same page with that and everybody understands.
So cool. I have my own translator, somebody who speaks English who can make sense of what I just said. This is like what they said to the Dalai Lama.
Teaching NLP using mind design. So people weren't coming to your practitioner trainings and not getting NLP, but they were getting NLP in a more effective, more impactful way.
Yeah, exactly. And the difficulty that we had as a company was that mind design was also an approach. In other words, mind design was also something I would teach in a 3 or 4 or 5 day workshop and I would take on the road. That was the stupidity of the marketing system that we had in place at the time. We didn't differentiate, but I didn't care. I mean, my point, well, I don't care. You know, I mean, to me, that was meaningless. What I wanted was people to come in and have an experience and kind of be immersed in the process and come out the other end better for it, rather than trying to intellectualize the process. You know, I could have made everything a technique. Instead, I didn't. I mean, I said there's things that we do in the morning and the evening. There's things that we did, you know, before every break and after every break and stuff like that that were part of the course, but they were designed to have people focus their attention differently, as opposed to think that, okay, now I'm doing an exercise, or now I'm doing this, or now I'm doing that. So, and then, of course, the questions is a huge aspect of it, the way you direct your own mind and direct your own experience and what you pay attention to.
Well, I can certainly, from the perspective of a student, reflect that I had a profound series of learning experiences and came out better for it as a result of it. And what's more, I think I mentioned to you in one of our previous conversations that I decided to move on to the Richard Bandler Master Practitioner course. Halfway through your course, I made the decision to attend Master Prac the same summer. So the day after, literally 6 a.m. after your course ended, I flew out to California and started Richard's Master Prac. And I can tell you that I was far better prepared for that course than the other master practitioner candidates were. There was no question that I had been transported to a different place. I understood intuitively more how things worked well and how to be tolerant of multiple descriptions and to let people be themselves and let however they needed to work was fine. So whatever you did, it worked. It worked profoundly well. And I would love, if possible, for us to schedule another teleconference at some point talking about mind design and your model for training and perhaps give people tastes of what that's about. I think that would be very valuable if you're willing.
No, absolutely. I think that'd be fine. But let me say this, and that is that when people get concerned about certification, people get concerned about, you know, pieces of paper, and what I said earlier, and one of the reasons I said it is that I wanted people who were, you know, head and shoulders above everybody else as a practitioner, master practitioner, or as a trainer, you know. So if they were going to have a certificate and they were going to say NLP practitioner, then it was meaningful. Sadly, and again, this may be something for later, but this is how my brain thinks. Sadly, you know, the field of NLP got diluted, and it got diluted by those on the inside the field and those without the field, and it became where almost this piece of paper became a meaningless thing. It's meaningful if you take the paper as an accomplishment, a self-accomplishment, but it's not going to buy you a cup of coffee out in the real world. You know, it's not, I am a practitioner certified by this body versus I'm a practitioner certified from that body. I think that if you get a certificate from somebody who's an exemplary trainer, that's notable. Then another person can go, oh, you said he was so-and-so. Well, that's cool. So it has value. But what happened with me was that I went, I don't care if people walk out of here being certified. What I care about is if people walk out of here having a life-changing experience. What I care about is, do they learn the skills enough to own the skills? And I know that some of these will be released in days and weeks and months to come after the program. They're going to have ahas as long as they continue this exploration. But can they? You know, my job has always been to diminish. In fact, when I disappeared from the NLP community, that is also a metaphor for how I think about training. My job is to disappear as a coach. You know, once you get coaching, you know, you go get coaching during the game, but you go out and play the game and then you get some coaching. But at some point, the coach has to vanish. You know, the teacher, you've got to leave the teacher. You have the guru's got to die and you go on. And so my goal in training has always been to hand somebody the football and go, okay, now it's your ball. You own it. Run with it. You know, I've given you the ball, you know, because, or you've earned the ball, or you've acquired the ball through the skills that you've developed and through your own inquisitiveness and through your own dedication. Now run it. Now run with it. Own it. Have a great life. And go live your life. You know, and then I'm gone. I vanish, you know, and people are on with their own thing. And in some ways, in 2001, when we closed their doors, it was kind of like, I have these candles running around out in the world who have their lights, and hopefully they'll go make, you know, a better world for themselves. And so for me to close the door in that regard was really just closing the door on the training and saying, hopefully the representatives out in the world will continue their journey. And that has, in most cases, or many cases, proven to be true.
Absolutely. To add some additional timeline, key timeline points in your NLP explorations and experiences and work, I met you in, let's say, I think it was April 1997, and then I attended your practitioner training in July 1997, or June, I think it was June. And as I recall, that was roughly 3 years after a particularly important chunk of your work in NLP. Because as I recall, it was around, let's say, January 20th or so, 1995, when the O.J. Simpson murder trial began. And you got involved with that. And I was wondering if you could spend just a couple minutes telling us about your experience there.
Yeah. I mean, I got a call from somebody in Los Angeles. I was, you know, and funny, during, I have seen more of the O.J. trial than probably a lot of humans. I had to record every hour of every day worth of courtroom stuff. And then all of the talking head stuff, like at that time it was CNN, and it was Greta Van Susteren, and somebody, and it was
Alan Dershowitz.
And it was Alan Dershowitz. I mean, you know, but I mean, all these talking heads that went on for over, you know, for over a year, and then the civil trial, but for over a year. And people made all these careers, but there was court TV, and I mean, I had two or three different TVs with, you know, 8-hour tapes in them running, you know, recording everything. During a part of that trial, I mean, I was in Los Angeles. I was asked to assess some members of the testimony of one particular witness and to assess the jurors from a standpoint. You know, people would call me and ask me what I would think. And I actually ended up in L.A. and was brought to the trial and to do this. I was a behind-the-scenes consultant for a lot of the news outlets. Anyway, during this time when I was not in L.A., I was doing practitioner and master practitioner programs. So I would train, you know, my schedule would be 12 or 15 hours a day. Then I would go back and I'd have to watch these tapes, you know, 8 hours worth of trial tape or whatever, and all this stuff, and then comment to the people who were asking for comments, and then go back the next morning and train the training. So, I mean, I literally around the clock was training and watching OJ and commenting on OJ and training, and it was a pretty full time, I will say that.
I will share with everybody here that I remember being absolutely gripped. I was completely engaged, switched on, locked on to what you were saying. When you started playing at our practitioner course, videotapes of Alan Dershowitz and some of the other talking heads to give us, let's say, modeling moments, things that we could have, after having taken most of the practitioner course, you were pointing out examples of behavior that you'd calibrated to. And I don't know if I would have come up at the time with the same judgments you came up with until you'd brought it to my attention, and then it was like I was ready to slap my forehead. Of course that was the moment when he just shifted, or it was extraordinary. So I just want to point out to those who are listening that if they've ever heard of the efficacy of NLP and calibration skills and people reading being questioned, Rex was the guy that was hired to be a consultant for the single most visible trial in U.S. legal history. And that's pretty profound.
I was just going to say, I mean, there were other consultants. I'm not the only person in the world that was a consultant for that.
Agreed.
You know, but I mean, I appreciate that. That is accurate in terms of the fact that somebody called me for that very reason. The thing that I do, and the thing that if anyone's ever lucky enough to listen to, you know, trainer training programs and master track programs that we have from years ago, is that I very meticulously did it in DHE, did it with NLP, did it with modeling, is have built very explicit models for myself for what's important in terms of modeling and how to extract behaviors. You know, I would diagram these things and everything else, but I'm not a book person, and throughout my entire career and to this day, I'm not a product person. So, I mean, I'm one of these people that goes, you have to be in the live seminar in order to experience it. And so, and I would fight with my own staff because they say, put out a book, put out a product. And I'm like, you know, it will pale by comparison. There's no substitute for the actual experience. It's kind of like, you know, you can't have sex vicariously. I mean, you can have sex, but you can't have it you can't just like, you know, there's things that you can't, like, eat a sandwich vicariously. You know, somebody's eating, you're eating it or you're not. If somebody tells you about eating a sandwich, it's just not the same thing. And reading a book about this, you know, even if you can bring back all the sensory experience about what it was like to have eaten a sandwich, it's not the same as eating the sandwich in that particular instant. And what the practitioner or master practitioner or trainer training, what we did when we looked at these videos when we were modeling and we were building models was to give multiple examples from different walks of life of people doing exactly the same thing who were at top of their field, who had exactly the same skill sets in this particular area, and to say, here are these three candidates or here are these six candidates. Now, compare what they're doing so that you can all find out how they are the same and what their skill sets are and look at all the things. Now notice how they're different in a different embodiment and what does that bring to it and what are each. So we had attorneys or we had comics or we had movie stars or we had therapists, you know, and we would go through and look at people who were, you know, extremely talented and go, okay, now take that information for yourself and build something for yourself. Like in the trainer training, we'd have people do a comedy routine. Why? Because most people are deathly afraid to get up, and comedy's hard. You know, it's hard for them to do. So get up and do 5 or 10 minutes of comedy. Why? Because it's one of the most challenging things in the world is to suddenly be funny if you're not. And time again, after having gone through the process and looking at these people and looking at the structure of how comedians build jokes and how they, you know, do things and how elegant speakers and attorneys make their arguments, they would get up and they would do a really, were they stand-up comedian ready? I mean, were they ready to go on The Tonight Show? No. But they were able to do something they had never done before by extracting these components. And again, it wasn't just the chunks. That's the big point. It's not just the individual pieces. It's how those pieces tie together and fit together and what the people seem to value.
All that.
Huh?
Okay. So to keep things moving in terms of the topics that we've chosen for today, let's shift a little bit back towards something we've partly covered already, which is about the value of an overall practitioner training. We'll just spend a few minutes coming back to the holistic or the grand chunk. I think when people want more authentic friendships, more open and honest and deep relationships, these are the things that are most valuable. People who want to build better companies and to achieve success or financial independence, the grand scheme is a much better frame from which to operate when considering taking a practitioner training. Do you want to talk about that a little?
What, again?
Mention briefly about some of the things that have sort of been at cause for the dilution of NLP in the marketplace. It seems as though everybody's going for the magic bullet. They want something quick and dirty. They want to get it in 7 days and now 5 days. And if they can get it online and get their certification, great, which strikes me as ridiculous. But
I'm going to use the sex metaphor again. I mean, I hate to go back to that, but do you want your sex inside of 30 seconds, or do you want it to take a nice long time? I mean, you know, anything of value is worth fighting for. It's worth spending time with. Do you want to spend a minute with your child or a lifetime with your child? What do you want? You know, when somebody goes, I got to have these skills, I got to have them yesterday. I understand that. I wanted the same thing. You know, nothing. Very few things in life are, I mean, that's the work of advertisers. You know, you can get something that chops your food and suddenly, you know, you're more potent. You can get a magic pill, and if you take it tomorrow, you're going to have abs like, you know, you can't believe. And all of it's pretty much crap, and we all know that, you know, and it's on TV and, you know, all this good stuff. Do you know nowadays advertisers have literally, they've passed legislation now that pretty much says they can lie to you however they choose to? I mean, it's just amazing. As long as they're a big corporation, you know, they don't have to worry about it because it's First Amendment speech. I mean, this is where we're going to hell in a handbasket. But the same thing has been applied to NLP. You got to get it faster. You got to get it, you know, here in a short period of time. You can master these skills and you can do all this stuff. Yes, you can get a fraction of something for a high cost, or, you know, you can go to McDonald's. No disparaging McDonald's. Now you can go get a fast meal, or you can go get a, you know, an incredible feast. The question becomes: is what is it that you want? If you want the feast, I say go for it. You know, I mean, because your interest is in doing something that is quick and easy and fast, and it's going to cost you, you know, X amount of dollars, and you're going to run off. And the bottom line is, you'll probably come back later on and go, you know, I didn't really get much value from it. I see that time and time and time and time again.
Or I do too, and I often find that when I talk to people who attempt, let's say they've attended an online certification course, or they've taken a 5-day certification course. And then, you know, if I ask them about it, they'll briefly denigrate having taken it. They're like, yeah, I know it wasn't as good as the longer course, but I thought I would get a certification fast. And my response to that has to question, were they thinking of the primary outcomes first? In other words, if they get the cheaper, faster certificate, chances are they're operating from a frame that says they're only focusing on getting clients quickly. Like, they must be in some kind of an impoverished place to begin with, thinking that this is a quick process, if I get the paper, then I can set up shop. And they're clearly not, in my opinion, thinking about, well, what happens when a client shows up? Are they well prepared? Can they change people's lives powerfully? Well, maybe a recipe that they've learned in a short course will work, and maybe it won't. Maybe they won't have the flexibility to deal with the unexpected or to work with somebody in a way that is creative and custom, and thereby sending people back out into the world having taken on a client and drastically improved their lives or helped them to drastically improve their lives. It seems to me that the short-sighted approach is not thinking about the bigger outcomes. It's thinking about themselves initially and as quickly as possible. And it sort of saddens me a little bit.
Well, you know, you can't save a fool from themselves a lot of times, and so the thing to do is stop trying. You know, it's if you throw somebody a life preserver and they don't grab onto it, you know, you can sit there and yell at them, but if they don't take it, they aren't going to take it. You know, you may have to dive in the water and help them in that way. But here's my take on all of this, and that is, and I've said this for, gosh, now it must be 25 or almost 30 years, NLP has forever offered the promise of being able to model skills and extract it from the original exhibitor of those skills and allow somebody to replicate that in a shorter amount of time than it took the original to learn. Now,
agreed.
A shorter amount of time is not specified. Okay, specification for shorter amount of time is up to marketers. It's up to what you see on television now. Shorter amount of time means that if you do it one day less than it took Milton Erickson, you did it in a shorter amount of time. If you do it 2 days less than Milton Erickson, you did it in a shorter amount of time. In other words, the goal is not to do things necessarily faster. It's to not have to make all of the same mistakes and reinvent the wheel. So you can streamline certain things. This is true. At the same time, wisdom comes from experience and from failure. And really, truly good masters and master practitioners of NLP have massive amounts of failure. They don't succeed all the time because you learn more from your failure in many ways than you do from your successes because you're too busy applauding yourself, you know, to learn from your successes. You learn from when it didn't work and when you had to readjust and when you had to readjust again and when you had to go back and readjust another time in order for it to finally get to work. And when you try and circumvent that process, the only person you shortchange is yourself because you don't become the seasoned professional that you want to be in the short amount of time in which somebody can offer a 3-day training or a 14-day training or something like that. It comes from practice and experience and by revisiting experience in a correct fashion time and time and time and time and time again. And if you don't like that fact, then don't do it. In other words, you got to be realistic about it. There's so much myth and so much garbage and so much crap of I will unscrew your head and pour it in. I will do this to you. You could, you know, and all these guys. It's
put that
garbage.
Out there, by the way.
Well, let me put this out there. That it at one time in the early books, it said that when people go to Virginia Satir and they say, how does Virginia do what she does? They said, well, the practitioners just say she intuits it. And they would say, well, that's shoddy epistemology. That's stupid. In the NLP books, go back and look at Richard Bandler saying this and John Grinder going, that's stupid. To say it's intuitive means nothing. It's not chunked down. It's not broken down. There's no procedure. It's bad, bad, bad. Don't do it. Now what happens in NLP, they go, hey, how did they do it? Well, somebody opened my head and poured it, and I have no idea how I do it. I just trust my unconscious.
Yeah, they were. It was installed.
It was installed. You know, it's all bogus. It's all bogus. You can do lots of things, but come on. I mean, you know, pigs don't fly. You know, NLP. You gotta be realistic. You gotta do your own investigative legwork. You gotta cut through the mire of all the crap that's out there and all the promises and all the things that are designed to make it sound better than it truly is. NLP represents, I think, a life-changing opportunity and technology. In the right hands, you know, it can be a really wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. And you can learn it, and you can learn it well, and you can learn it quickly. You can embody certain things. To become a maestro of it, it's going to take a lifetime like it would to be a great piano player. You know, and if you got all the right technique for piano and you learn the shortcuts, even then it still takes a lifetime to be really good. The question becomes, what do you want to be? You want to be a half-assed practitioner who did it in 3 days and put some shingle up, or do you want to be somebody who's really good at something? Now, having said that, why do you want to be good at it? You know, hopefully you want to be good at it so that you have a better life. And if you really, truly want a better life, then get the better life skills. You know,
I absolutely agree. I'm going to keep things moving here and say, of course, to me, you're preaching to the choir, but, of course, hopefully the message gets through to other people as well. I had a profound experience at your course with the advent or the use of your feedback loops, the opportunity to get coaching from you as we went along. I remember, I'll just share a couple of quick stories and ask you to comment if you would. I remember that I spent 6 months, roughly, maybe a little bit more, self-studying NLP very aggressively before showing up at your practitioner course. I mean, I was spending 3 to 5 nights out per week, not to mention what subtle tests I was creating for myself at business meetings and consulting experiences with the company that I was working at the time. And in my evenings out, I would preface each visit out to a coffee shop or to wherever with an intention. I started with an intention, and I would say, I'm going to study this, or I'm going to test the use and recognition of this particular language pattern. I was very, very active, more active than I think most students tend to be. And I learned things, and I remember showing up at your practitioner course after 6 months of self-study, and 2 days in already, and I'm already aware, profoundly aware, of how much more I had learned in just a couple of days through your guided, structured exercises than I'd spent 6 months acquiring previously. And the difference was profound. It was unmistakable. At the time, of course, I didn't have the filters or the refined awareness to really understand why that was the case. But I tell you, I was fascinated with it. And I was attempting to balance my energies and the time in your course between having the full experience and also evaluating it and trying to figure out what are the distinctions that are most important between how I used to structure exercises on my own and how you were structuring them and what you were telling us consciously to focus on and what we were acquiring, let's say, perhaps other than consciously. And it was a fascinating subject for me. Could you share any thoughts you have on why that's so much more valuable than attempting self-study?
Yes, I could. The question is, do we have enough time, and do we have time to get to the questions if people have questions, because I when I have an opportunity to interact with people on the phone. I will say that there's no substitute for high-quality feedback. I said it earlier in the conversation, and maybe we tabled it, but the idea that somebody can be there and can assist you in paying attention to things and in eliciting from you your own learning, there's the opportunity for people in a live program working with, or even if it's not a program, working one-on-one with a coach or a mentor or an assistant, but the ability to take a live NLP training in this situation, like what you were in when you were in my program at the time, you know, is structured to have you, the person, have ahas. It's to bring out that curiosity in you, to bring out the fascination in you, to bring out the interest in you, to bring out a discovery in you, to allow you to pay attention to things you may not otherwise pay attention to in normal consciousness, and thereby learn something of great value for yourself about your ability to recognize things that you hadn't previously recognized. If it only becomes like when watching modeling tapes, if I sit there the whole time and point things out, then people go, oh, okay, I got that. But they didn't notice it in and of themselves. So having people be able to notice it and draw that from them is a huge key to learning.
I remember we were doing an exercise with sensory-rich language. We were learning how to be more vivid with our communication using visual, auditory, and kinesthetic language, and you were encouraging us and teaching us how to identify where our strengths were and where our weaknesses were and to build up our weaknesses and to become more aware of what we were consciously strong in versus unconsciously strong in, consciously weak in versus unconscious. I mean, there were some distinctions there. And I will tell you that my first assumptions of where my strengths and weaknesses were completely wrong. I mean, I was applying some judgment I had come to based on my knowledge of myself to that date. And the awakening there, I won't call it a rude awakening, I'll call it a fabulous surprise, was that I didn't know myself as well as I thought I had. And it wouldn't have happened unless you hadn't been walking past me at the moment that exercise was being run and brought to not only my attention, but the people I was working with at the time, something that none of us were seeing or hearing. I mean, it was just beyond all of our awareness. But once the others in the group had, let's say, become aware of what you were pointing out in my own language and behavior, they were more attuned to it. And then I kept repeating some of the same mistakes a couple of times further, and having them policing those moments helped me to become more at cause with those moments of opportunity as opposed to having missed them already. And that was extraordinarily valuable. And that was true of all of the exercises you constructed. And without that external feedback from more refined eyes, ears, et cetera, I don't know that I would have been anywhere near as further along as I was after your course. So that was a very valuable thing for me.
How marvelous. That's so cool.
Yeah, it was really cool. Why don't we ask people who are itching to ask any questions one by one to unmute themselves and say, hi, this is so-and-so, name yourself. So if you've got a question, one by one we'll ask you what they are.
Hi, and you can unmute Tony in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, John. Hi, Rex.
Hey, Tony. How you doing?
Hey, I'm very excited about all of this. And I have a question for you, Rex. Now, Rex, you've been outside of the training game for some time. Can we count you to dust off the cobwebs in November?
Well, you can count on me to dust off the cobwebs. But I have not been far from training. I still train and consult. I just haven't offered public seminars, you know. And you know, I'm like, you know, for hire. So, I mean, people bring me in for different things, but it hasn't been the NLP community that's been bringing me in. So I've not been far removed from doing what I've always done. I just haven't done it publicly in the NLP community. And again, I managed to keep things up until this moment fairly compartmentalized. So when I was doing the private entertainment for corporations, I didn't tell my NLP people what I was doing because I didn't want them to be distracted with what I was doing that way. But I would tell the corporations that I was doing NLP training. So, I mean, one half knew, but the other half didn't. So, I mean, I tend to do that. So, but, yes, I will dust off. I will polish up. I will clean all the corners and bring full game to the training in November.
I'm excited.
Thank you, Tony.
Tony, go ahead and mute yourself again. And if anyone else has a question, please go ahead and unmute yourself with a *6.
I have a question.
Sure. Who is this?
This is Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Go ahead.
This question is for Rex. I was curious. I know I've watched different things with Darren Brown about faith healing, and I was wondering about your insights about the relationship between NLP, hypnosis, faith healing, and some specific techniques like being slain in spirit and things like that.
So that I understand the question, you're asking about the similarity between NLP, faith healing, and hypnosis?
Yeah, the similarities, most specifically.
Well, my experience, I mean, you know, I was a teenager, and I was hanging out in evangelical churches and you know, road shows and tent shows and things like that, and working with various ministers, and there were things that I saw that defied explanation in many ways. I saw some things where I couldn't account or couldn't explain how people did what they did. I also saw fraud. I also saw people who would get there and manipulate things and say, okay, the person's been healed, and the person would get up and limp off, you know, but they hadn't been healed. So, I mean, you saw both sides of that. I think the mind is a very powerful thing. I don't think that anybody has got, you know, a true handle on it. I think that through hypnosis, I think through the power of belief, I think you will see spontaneous healing. I think that, you know, sadly, the medical profession, because of its remedial form or its repair rather than preventative, rather than, you know, how do you have health, will obviously come along and go, well, if there's a spontaneous healing, it couldn't have been a problem to begin with. You know, we must have misdiagnosed it because obviously, we're never in error. The mind can do any number of incredible things. I think you can see things happen. I think that people may get up and walk, and yet at the same time, there are people who believe and don't get up and walk. And I have no answer for stuff like that. I go.
I would like to and add a little bit of something and say that I think that a lot of that has to do with the power of belief.
Well, yes. I mean, it absolutely does. Typically what happens in some of these cases is someone will come along and say, well, your belief isn't strong enough, and they will blame the person for not being healed, which, while it may be accurate, it may not be accurate. Maybe the person absolutely does believe, and there's just no reason for why there isn't a healing. I'm sorry, Mark. There's so many different aspects to this question that, you know, if we could sit down and talk about, you know, a variety of things and kind of tease it out more. But I think that like anything, you know, you can use NLP, you can use hypnosis to do almost anything except walk on water or fly. You know, Bandler's thing was you can fly but not for very long, you know, and so the bottom line is practice from the curb, not from the rooftop, is the wise way to approach it. The door is open, you know, and I think what faith healing and those kinds of things do is they set examples for what could be possible, and we still have to figure out how to make it, you know, more an everyday reality. I'm sorry, I don't even know if I answered your question, Mark. You tell me.
Yeah, it answered my question. It was meant to be a little open-ended because I know that you have a lot of knowledge about this thing, that type of stuff. So thank you very much.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, here's one thing I will say, and there was another question somebody asked earlier that I'd kind of like to ask or respond to if I have the chance. But one of the things is this. Ultimately, what I'm all about really is about waking up. You know, I typed on Facebook today, and some people like my Facebook, some people don't. You know, I tend to be controversial on Facebook at times. But I said, if you're sleeping and somebody sneaks into your house and takes your television set, you don't know that your TV set is missing until you wake up and look around and notice that it's gone because you were asleep. You know, you were unconscious. You didn't know that something was going on. Now you can say, well, my other conscious knew and all that kind of stuff. Okay, fine. But the point is that consciously you did not know what was going on. The key to a lot of NLP is to wake up and to understand unconscious processes and be able to articulate what is going on, which is the basis then of skill. If you can say, well, I did this and this and this and this and this, then you understand your approach. You know, you don't go to a carpenter and go, how did you build the house? He doesn't say, well, I don't know. I just thought about it one day and it was there. He says, well, you have to, you know, create a blueprint, and then you put in a foundation, and then you get, you know, your tools and everything, and it comes together, and there's a procedure for doing it, and that's what a lot of NLP is about, and that's what a lot of things are. At the same time, we don't want to be inhibited or limited by the procedures, meaning that our unconscious is this vast storehouse, this vast thing where there's all sorts of possibility and potential for things that we don't even know, and we do work intuitively. And the key is to create balance. The key is to get both aspects of ourselves kind of working in harmony and to wake up to possibilities that we didn't know existed and to wake up as people so that we're not gullible and we're not stupid and we don't buy, you know, mythology. We become alert to the fact that these things are going on, you know, that people are trying to, you know, market to us in stupid ways. They're not stupid ways, but I mean, they're using, you know, mythology.
Well, some are.
Well, yes, indeed. But what I mean is you know, there's we're to stop being gullible and to wake up to who you are more than anything else. Wake up to the unique expression you are in the universe. Wake up to your own personal flowering and then blossom with true potential in a way that no one else in the universe could do. You know, wake up. It's just waking up. And as one of my favorite little gurus said, it's the difference between an enlightened person and a non-enlightened person is the enlightened person is awake and the non-enlightened person is sleeping. And so all that says is that, you know, one time I was sleeping and then I woke up, and someday you'll wake up too if you're sleeping now. So the ultimate outcome is to simply wake up. And to wake up to what's possible and what's potential and what's joyous and what's fun and what's ecstatic and what creates good relationships, and wake up to, you know, having more fun in your work and all that kind of stuff.
Wonderful. That was a really lovely, I think, place for us to call it a night, I think. I'm sure there are some other questions.
I want to talk about somebody, so Phoenix asked a question and said, I saw it on Facebook or something, why are so many communicators have problems, or, well, you know, if they're experts at communication, why are there these issues? And I'd want to definitely, the next teleconference, I definitely want to be able to address that and
great.
Many other things.
And I've already got some really exciting topics that are sort of emerging from our conversations as well. We'll respect your time and your contributions and say, you know, just a huge thank you for agreeing to spend some time on the phone. I mean, we're already talking about the practitioner course coming up in November, but giving time now in advance of that, you know, with no extensive plan in place, just open-ended conversations to bring value to people, it's a gift, and I'm grateful. So thank you.
Well, me too. And, you know, back when you were at my practitioner and things like that, you know, we would train for 12 hours a day and then we'd sit up all night long talking. And there's nothing cooler than talking to people and finding out who they are and meeting, you know, and finding out what interests we have in common and what things we don't know. And to be able to have these discussions, the opportunity, hopefully, to meet and to actually interact with those people who are on the call is an exciting it's an adventure, and it's exciting and most marvelous. And if we get to meet in November, that's even more exquisite. But the opportunity to talk to people who are fascinated by NLP, and whether they're people who've had 20 years of NLP or people who've had 2 days of NLP, it's a delight to be here. So thank you very much.
Again, thank you. And to those who are attending tonight and still with us, thank you very much for spending some time listening in. I know there wasn't a lot of interaction. Perhaps for the next one, I'll have a chat room in place so that there will be more opportunities for interaction. And again, if you've got a couple more questions, then wait for just a minute. I will say that for the next event, I believe we've got one scheduled in about 3 weeks. I will send an email out soon to the list with our specific schedule and timing. And I will also send another email shortly once we've got the download version of this available for people accessible through the web. When you do get that email, if you decide to download it and listen to it again, I would encourage you, please, 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 share the fact that you attended or the fact that you're listening to it with your friends, but please don't share the download links without sending them first to the subscriber location so that we know who's interested and can communicate with them directly. Have them download it by subscribing first and then getting the information from Rex or myself. We're hoping to do it that way, and please honor that. So, again, thank you very much for spending your time with us this evening. And if you're listening from home, thanks for listening. I hope you really enjoyed this chat with Rex. What an opportunity. It's just quite a pleasure to have the opportunity to chat and tap into Rex's wisdom and knowledge and skill. So, until next time, and thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.